Chapter 4. The donor class buys itself a political party. American plutocrats have become rich enough to buy themselves a party. Paul Krugman, Conscience of a Liberal, 2007. Economic and geographic segregation have immunized those at the top from the problems of those down below. Like the kings of yore, they have come to perceive their privileged positions essentially as a natural right. Joseph Stiglitz, June 2014. The political preferences and personal agendas of the stupendously wealthy in America matter a great deal. Most of America's richest individuals are highly active politically, and their vast resources give them a disproportionate influence on U.S. politics. Harvard political scientists Vanessa Williamson and Theda Skocpol, the former president of the American Political Science Association, note that wealth and income have become so amazingly unequal in the United States that a few hundred billionaire families have the means to push their own worldview in civic and political affairs. When it comes to setting agendas for public discussion and policy debates, encouraging entire convoys of organizations or officeholders to move in one direction or another, the super-duper wealthy in America today can make quite a difference. At the very highest levels of wealth and disposable income, resources are so stupendous that the personal outlooks, even quirks, of the super-rich matter. In 2012, for instance, 388 of the wealthiest Forbes 400 made political contributions. Their agendas matter because their generosity has come to dominate political contributions and political issue advertising. In 1980, the richest 0.1%, 0.1% of donors contributed less than 10% of all campaign contributions. In 2012, their share was greater than 44%. In 2016, their share reached 2/3 of donations to congressional candidates, and it dominated contributions in hundreds of state contests. Their political preferences matter because the personal outlooks, even quirks, of these political active multimillionaires and billionaires are shared by few other Americans. As noted in Chapter 2, they are disdainful of middle and lower class priorities. In this chapter, we'll see how they have adopted the GOP to implement their agenda. Even so, their agendas are so uniquely self-serving that they are often at odds with the preferences of their fellow Republican Party members. Affluent political donors have favored the Republican Party since the Gilded Age, transforming the party of Lincoln into a refuge for the privileged. That bias eased for a generation before Reagan during the post-war decades, when moderate Republicans ascended. Indeed, the party's collaboration and cooperation with Democrats were instrumental in the rise of the great American middle class and the resurrection of civil rights. Since Reagan, however, that trend has dissipated. The Gilded Age bias has reappeared. That trend accelerated in the early 1990s when congressional Republicans sought political ascendancy by formally adopting a pay-to-play strategy to lure wealthy donors. Both the GOP's agenda and power and influence within the party itself were explicitly linked by former Congressman Tom DeLay's K Street Project to servicing wealthy donors. This shift to transactional politics is evident in the evolution of GOP party platforms. In 1992, for example, the GOP had advocated limits on soft money donations and favored elimination of corporate and union PACs. But by 2004, it had reversed course, deciding that any funding restrictions violated the First Amendment. To appease the donor class, GOP moderates had to accept a small government agenda that conflicted with their post-war support of Medicare, capital gains taxes, and stronger public schools. Moderates began abandoning the party. Others were culled from leadership positions in a process managed by officials including Newt Gingrich, or defeated in primaries. This shift to transactional politics has been rewarded by corporate America and by the fittest. Cornell University economist Jin-Hyuk Kim found that only 20 of the S&P 500 index firms during the period 1998 to 2004 donated primarily or exclusively to Democrats, while tenfold more, 206, primarily or exclusively contributed to Republican lawmakers. Among the 200 best-compensated CEOs in 2016, the nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics notes they gave $6.50 to the GOP for every dollar going to Democrats, a clear propensity to support Republicans. Moreover, among the wealthy, some 158 families accounted for nearly half of all contributions to the 2016 presidential race, made during the critical money primary season in 2015, with nearly all, 138 or 87%, supporting Republicans. Very few wealthy donors follow the lead of George Soros or environmental advocate Tom Steyer, who favor Democrats. The rightward shift with the departure of moderates is reflected in a Pew Research Center finding that the share of Republicans viewing government as an enemy increased nearly 60% between 1996 and 2015. By contrast, the share of Democrats viewing it as an enemy changed little, and the share viewing it as a friend rose nearly 20%. An example of this transformation is the issue of renewable energy that moderate Republicans, such as former Senator Chuck Percy of Illinois, in the past supported, no longer. Beginning in 2010, the fittest, led by the Koch brothers, spent tens of millions of dollars in primary contests on behalf of climate deniers. Their lobbyist, Tim Phillips, explained the consequence. After that, renewable energy disappeared from Republican ads. Part of that was the polling, and part of that was the visceral example of what happened to their colleagues who had done that. It told the Republicans that we were serious, that we would spend some serious money against them. Calling of moderates from Republican ranks was important because it set the stage for the Tea Party. That, in turn, enabled opportunistic donors to unduly influence these staunchly conservative GOP grassroots that came to dominate party primary elections and conventions. Tea Party grassroots. The donor class's disproportionate influence on the GOP. Using the formulation devised in 1982 by political economist Manker Olson, The Rise and Fall of Nations, the donor class has emerged as the pinnacle distributional coalition in American politics. Most of its members have far more at stake than you or me from specific public policies, and thus are willing to spend mightily to influence those specific policies. Think fossil fuel industry moguls, hedge fund managers, or pharmaceutical firm CEOs. Most are small government aficionados, and some have spent years shaping public opinion, as Nancy McLean detailed in Democracy in Chains, 2017, or Jane Meyer of The New Yorker noted in 2016. Families like the Scaifes, Coors, Ricketts, and Kochs were among a small, rarefied group of hugely wealthy, arch-conservative families that for decades poured money, often with little public exposure, into influencing how the Americans thought and voted. As 2009 unfolded, some of these activist donors seized the moment offered by the emergence of the Tea Party to rather dramatically increase their influence within the GOP, described here by Scotchbowl and Williamson. A vast network of policy-oriented right-wing intellectual organizations, generously funded, has been strategizing and writing for many years, awaiting the moment when political and electoral winds might shift just enough to allow their ideas to find a larger place on the mainstream agenda. National organizations, such as FreedomWorks and Americans for Prosperity, both belonging to the Koch brothers, suddenly saw fresh opportunities to push long-standing ideas about reducing taxes on business and the rich, gutting government regulations, and privatizing Social Security and Medicare. By dint of wallet, wealthy donors began to dramatically enhance the reach of those social conservative GOP grassroots activists. The Kochs were among the original financiers of the Tea Party movement, explain New York Times journalists Cheryl Gay Stolberg and Mike McIntyre. Journalist Yurik Martin of the Financial Times adds, "It is the Kochs and their ilk who have fueled the Tea Party engine, radical Washington institutions with mellifluous and innocent-sounding names, Freedom Works, Americans for Prosperity, and the National Taxpayers Union, have thrived under their largesse. Their support was matched by the conservative media mogul Rupert Murdoch, owner of Fox News, who sought a niche to distinguish his network from the mainstream broadcast behemoths ABC, CBS, and NBC. Commentator Frank Rich considers Murdoch's March 2009 directive that his media empire publicize the Tea Party to be as instrumental as Coke cash in its rise. The Kochs surely match the in-kind donations the Tea Party receives in free promotion 24/7 from Murdoch's Fox News. Fox has been a right-wing mouthpiece and echo chamber in the years since, routinely and more recently relentlessly peddling conspiracies and half-truths that observers today would term fake news. Here is New York Times journalist Nick Corasaniti. The network has provided a strategic path for Republican politicians and candidates with a message. To raise an issue, set an agenda, or change the talk around a charged topic, go to Fox News. Scotchpole and Williamson explained the lure of Tea Partiers to the decidedly upscale donor class. Alignment with Tea Party activists is the latest elite maneuver in the war against taxes and associated push to dismantle costly popular social programs like Medicare and Social Security. Now the anti-tax mantra would have some popular oomph behind it, enthusiastic backing from the ranks of ordinary middle-class conservatives attending Tea Party rallies and meetings. Indeed, the Tea Party erupted at just the right moment to cut Obama and the Democrats off at the pass in the never-ending war to reduce regulations on business and free the U.S. wealthy from having to pay taxes to sustain social supports for their fellow citizens. That is how the situation looks to right-wing interests. GOPers loyal to ultra-right agendas can roll back government spending, smash unions that are politically aligned with Democrats, and, above all, block tax increases on the privileged. Studying the mechanics of intra-party Republican politics in light of the rise of the Tea Party, the donor class quickly mastered its vulnerability. The departure of moderates had left staunch conservatives disproportionately influential in party primaries. The Tea Party appellation has become unpopular even among conservatives in recent years. Even so, Pew surveys have found that 49% of those who always vote in GOP primaries are self-identified Tea Partiers or their ideological mates. More than 50% who voted in the GOP 2012 primaries were evangelicals. When combined with other self-identified conservatives, right-wing voters have come to represent fully 75% of those who always vote in GOP primaries. The donor class has magnified the rightward shift of the GOP by further culling remaining moderates in recent election cycles. Journalist Joe Rothstein explains what occurred during 2010 in North Carolina. James Arthur Art Pope is an extraordinarily wealthy North Carolina native who has invested tens of millions of dollars in buying legislative and congressional seats and as many statewide offices as his fortune, mostly inherited, can buy. Many of the 18 moderate state senators and delegates across North Carolina swept from office in 2010 by Pope's cash were moderate Republicans. The process was described this way by one of the defeated. "They spent nearly $1 million to win my state Senate seat. A lot of it was from corporations and outside groups related to Art Pope. He was their sugar daddy." In 2012, Koch money helped defeat 8 moderate Republican state senators in Kansas primaries. In Arkansas, conservative donors spent millions of dollars ousting moderates in a state where politicians traditionally spent a few thousand dollars, as noted by Democratic State Senator Robert Thompson in November 2012. If any outside group comes in and spends $10,000, that's a big chunk of what the candidates are going to spend. In Fighting for Common Ground, former Senator Olympia Snowe of Maine, a moderate Republican, writes that her party's grassroots with Tea Party sympathies hold the most extreme views within our party, seeking to purify it by defeating moderates. Her congressional history of collaborating with Democrats attracted a chorus of boos at the state Republican convention in Bangor in early 2012, causing her to end her re-election bid. Only in a few instances of overreach, such as Kansas Governor Sam Brownback in 2016, has the culling been reversed. Donor class spending pushed the GOP rightward even when their favored candidates didn't prevail in primaries. The threat of an intra-party contest or a sizable negative advertising buy can be enough. Senators Ron Wyden and Lisa Murkowski in December 2012 noted that congressional voting is often colored by the prospect of facing $5 million in anonymous attack ads if a member of Congress crosses an economically powerful interest. Gerrymandering has also helped conservatives triumph over moderates, and as a result, a sizable number of general election outcomes are increasingly determined by sparsely attended primaries in one-party legislative districts. Indeed, gerrymandering has caused the number of actual competitive elections for Congress to become minuscule. The Cook Report, for instance, found only 32 races out of 435 in 2016 were decided by a margin of 10 percentage points or less, compared to at least 123 races in 1992, 1994, and 1996. It is the same story in state elections. Some 71% of candidates in the November 2015 state election ran unopposed for the Virginia House of Delegates, heavily gerrymandered by the GOP. Not a single incumbent legislator was defeated. Careful to preserve their careers, those same legislators in mid-February 2017 vetoed placing a voter referendum on redistricting reform on the Virginia November 2017 ballot. These dark corners of American politics were conceived explicitly to strengthen one-party rule. The consequence is to facilitate the fittest agenda by enabling immoderate voters in primaries rather than in general elections to dictate who serves in Congress. The Koch apparatus. A number of wealthy families, such as the Mercers, part owners of the white supremacist website Breitbart, were important in the Trump and GOP victories in 2016. The Adelsons alone donated more than $40 million to Donald Trump and the GOP. But the Koch brothers stand out for their heft, their skill as political tacticians, and the vast scope of their political activities, which equal or exceed the reach of the Republican Party itself. They have emerged as a highly effective and sophisticated third force in American politics alongside the two political parties. Kenneth Vogel explained in Politico, "The Koch political operation has become among the most dominant forces in American politics, rivaling even the official Republican Party in its ability to shape policy debates and elections." In 2012, the Koch apparatus of 400 mega-donors spent about $400 million supporting the GOP, more than double the spending in opposition by the 10 largest labor unions. Although they refused to contribute to the narcissistic Donald Trump, they marshaled a reported $750 million during the 2016 election cycle to support down-ballot conservatives, funding 1,600 full-time, year-round staff in 107 offices across 38 states. Their network has spent over $1.5 billion since the mid-2000s to identify and support conservative Republicans, with a preference for electable libertarians. Former Obama White House official Chris Lehane spelled it out. The Koch brothers have effectively acquired the Republican Party and repurposed it. Scotchpole and Williamson explained that the goal of the Kochs and other conservative moguls is to remake the Republican Party into a disciplined, uncompromising machine devoted to radical free market goals. The income bias, The attacks on Obamacare, tax cuts, deregulation of environmental and labor rules, and the decline in the share of GDP attributed to government spending are evidence that these billionaires have largely succeeded in seizing the agenda of the GOP. Certainly, many thoughtful Republicans believe they have, including the commentator Ross Douthat, who acknowledges that the party's basic orientation has become a tool of moneyed interests. A prediction made by commentator Frank Rich in 2010 has been realized. Yet, inexorably, the Koch agenda is morphing into the GOP agenda, as articulated by current Republican members of Congress. Their program opposes a federal deficit, but has no objection to running up trillions in red ink and tax cuts for corporations and the super-rich, while it opposes the extension of unemployment benefits. The fittest 50. Not all Republicans, or even all conservatives, are pleased with this turn of events. South Carolina GOP Senator Lindsey Graham, in April 2015, lamented the role being played by a few dozen wealthy donors in his state's presidential primary, arguing, basically, 50 people are running the entire show. In honor of social Darwinians, such as William Graham Sumner, the conservative donor class is henceforth in this book referred to as the fittest 50. A close contender was the fittest 100, because the Center for Responsive Politics found that the top 1% of Super PAC contributors in 2012 were responsible for two-thirds of their donations. That is a universe of about 100 people and their spouses. Also considered was the fittest 195, because the Brennan Center for Justice noted in 2016 that about 60% of the $1 billion in campaign spending channeled through super PACs in the 5 years since Citizens United had come from 195 people. Pin money. It's just one quarter's dividend. That's how billionaire hedge fund manager Bill Ackman described the relatively trivial cost of funding a political campaign, even for a presidential primary aspirant. Ready examples include Bill Marriott's support of Mitt Romney, Foster Fries and Rick Santorum, Harold Simons and Rick Perry, Norman Braman and Marco Rubio, Robert Mercer, the Wilkes brothers, and Ted Cruz. The list grows longer with each election. A candidate's political appeal, stage presence, and campaign organization are vital elements in a competitive political contest, but so is money. That makes the fittest 50 indispensable to aspiring politicians in both parties, rare exceptions being aspirants such as Dr. Ben Carson, Donald Trump, or Bernie Sanders, who mobilized small donors. Controversial or prominent figures such as Trump, who are able to garner massive free media exposure, are also less reliant on the fittest 50. Indeed, MediaQuant concluded that Donald Trump benefited from an astounding $4.6 billion in free cable and broadcast coverage during 2016, garnering considerably more exposure than Secretary Clinton. Even so, Trump received lavish donations from multimillionaires and billionaires Sheldon Adelson, Ronald Cameron, Betsy DeVos, Harold Hamm, Bernard Marcus, Rebecca Mercer, Linda McMahon, Steven Mnuchin, Wilbur Ross, Anthony Scaramucci, and Peter Thiel, among others. At the presidential level in November, the breadth of popular support for major candidates neutralizes any advantage of political money, as noted by researchers such as Thomas Frank, Jane Mayer, and journalists like Stephen Perlstein and E.J. Dionne Jr. However, that parity disappears when it comes to down-ballot races. Support from the fittest 50 has been instrumental to the success in recent years of the GOP at the state level, especially during off-year elections. A very modest dump of campaign cash by national standards, $10 million or $20 million, has proved sufficient for quick-witted local conservatives to capture entire state governments. In fact, well-funded Republicans captured a near majority of state governments in 2010, building on grassroots energized by criticism of big government, Democratic elitism, and Obamacare. That brought control of the 2011 redistricting process in those states, with the resulting gerrymandering enabling Republicans to solidify their hold on the House of Representatives. Low turnout and frustration with Democrats were powerful factors in the Republican ascendancy, beginning with the 2010 election. But donations from conservatives, unleashed by the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling in January 2010, were also important. Kenneth Vogel explained its impact this way. It changed the mindset of big donors and big money operatives. Perhaps more importantly, it introduced the idea that a single ultra donor, or a well-connected consultant with the ears of a handful of mega donors, could fundamentally shift a campaign for the U.S. presidency, not to mention a handful of Senate or governor's races or dozens of House seats. The centrality of Citizens United to this political success is confirmed by an elaborate analysis by Tillman Klump, Hugo Mialon, and Michael Williams. They examined the ruling's specific impact, utilizing as a control group those states that had previously prohibited corporate political spending. They concluded that new corporate contributions to GOP candidates at state-level races in 2010 and 2012 increased the Republicans' odds of winning individual elections by an average of 4 percentage points. Their findings drew on data from 29,698 state House races and 8,517 state Senate races in 49 states. Importantly, in the swing states of Michigan, Minnesota, North Carolina, and Ohio, plus the red states of Montana and Tennessee, GOP odds improved by a minimum of 10 percentage points, and they increased by 7 percentage points in Texas, Colorado, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Wyoming. Moreover, Citizens United was found to reduce the number of citizens donating to campaigns. It also reduced the number of candidates willing to run as Democrats. The hundreds of millions of dollars contributed to this and more recent GOP electoral successes did not jeopardize fortunes of the fittest 50. An extreme example is the casino owners Miriam and Sheldon Adelson. Their contributions and political issue advertising in 2012 alone was greater than the combined contributions from all donors in 12 of the smaller states like Delaware, Idaho, and Maine. They squandered some $91.8 million boosting Newt Gingrich and others during the 2012 election cycle. Yet their wealth increased by $14.4 billion in 2013. Most U.S. billionaires were lukewarm to candidate Trump in 2016, but spent lavishly on behalf of other candidates. Even so, like the Adelsons, the aggregate wealth of American billionaires in 2016 increased, a total rise of $77 billion, according to the Bloomberg Billionaires Index, far beyond their outlays. It's just pin money. The Wiktionary defines pin money as an amount not particularly significant for routine expenses or incidentals. You know, cash spent on whatnots, including the wardrobe pins for Henry VIII's wives. The Kochs spent less than 1% of their fortune in the 2016 election cycle. Chicago hedge fund billionaire Kenneth Griffin spent more money on the Rauner race for Illinois governor than every member of 244 labor unions. He can afford it because his after-tax income is $68.5 million a month. None of these billionaire donors is less wealthy after their contributions. They remain as rich as Croesus, just pin money. The process at work is explained by French economist Thomas Piketty, noting that size effects enable even the most extravagant to live well on a tiny portion of their income, the balance saved and reinvested to grow even more. That process is exemplified by a handful of Florentine families who have managed to sustain wealth since 1427. Four of the five families with the highest incomes in 2014 were in the top 3% of earners there in 1427, according to research by Guglielmo Baroni and Sauro Mossetti. Those who earned the most among current taxpayers were already at the top of the socioeconomic ladder there 6 centuries ago. I pledge allegiance to the fittest 50. Adopting the fittest 50 agenda has transformed Republicans to be the first uniformly conservative party in American history. GOP lawmakers are certainly subject to other powerful influences in crafting policy, including tightly focused and organized interest groups such as the gun lobby, right-to-life advocates, the Chamber of Commerce, staunch conservatives such as the Freedom Caucus, and the like. But when it comes to economics, the income bias documents that shrewd GOP lawmakers have adopted the fittest 50 agenda of small government and wage suppression as their own. Maintaining this fealty has been awkward at times. In 2017, most congressional Republicans sought to strip health insurance from 20 million working-class Americans to fund $300 billion in tax cuts for the fittest. And on global warming since 2010, they have been required to suspend reason, evidence, and critical thinking to avoid offending the Koch brothers. The New York Times investigative reporters Carol Davenport and Eric Lipton explain, Koch Industries and Americans for Prosperity started an all-fronts campaign with television advertising, social media, and cross-country events aimed at electing lawmakers who would ensure that the fossil fuel industry would not have to worry about new pollution regulations. Put differently, timorous Republican lawmakers since 2010 have urged voters to ignore the ocean lapping at living rooms in Miami and Norfolk. Move on, nothing to see here. As Stuart Stevens, a GOP strategist, acknowledges, the Republican Party has greatly changed. Mann and Ornstein argue that the GOP has been tarnished by its pursuit of the fittest 50 agenda they described as an unabashed ambition to reverse decades of economic and social policy by any means. Their tactics, reliance on a drumbeat of fake news, polarizing voters, and shutting down the government twice, for instance, are indicative of a political party that has fallen out of the historic American political mainstream. It is as if one of the many paranoid fringe movements in American political history has successfully infected a major political party. What used to be seen as loony is now broadly accepted or tolerated. Falling unduly under the spell of the fittest 50 has also placed the GOP well on the fringe among all political parties in the higher quality democracies. In 2012, Paul Quinn, a legislator from the conservative New Zealand National Party, explained the consequences to visiting American Fulbright scholars. I will explain to you how our system works compared to yours. You have Democrats and Republicans. My labor opponents would be Democrats. I am a member of the National Party, and we would be Democrats as well. Moreover, pursuit of the fittest 50 agenda represents a de facto disavowal of the Republicans' Lincolnian roots as the party of opportunity for average Americans. That is particularly evident in Republican Party support of wage suppression. Indeed, the fittest 50 and executive suites have made the advocacy of higher wages a third rail of internal Republican Party politics. GOP lawmakers have logically responded by opposing higher minimum wage laws, independent contractor reforms, collective bargaining, overtime pay reform, paid parental leave, or preventing wage theft through stricter enforcement of wage and overtime regulations. Hostility to these pillars of middle-class prosperity is a bizarre position for any political party in a democracy, but flows naturally from the GOP's allegiance to the fittest 50. GOP lawmakers prioritize the fittest 50 agenda over party faithful. Finally, adoption of the fittest 50 agenda has caused GOP lawmakers to ignore the major economic policy preferences of party grassroots beyond just higher wages. The results of a CBS New York Times survey from 2015 are informative. Some 85% of Americans, including 77% of Republicans, support requiring corporations and other employers to provide paid sick leave for employees, for instance. See chart 4.1. Similar proportions of GOP party members also support paid parental leave and raising taxes to buttress Social Security, policy preferences studiously ignored by Republican lawmakers. The disconnect between the preferences of the GOP grassroots and party lawmakers has forced the latter to adopt a bait-and-switch strategy. Action on hot-button issues, such as Obamacare, traditional marriage, or abortion rights, has been promised. But progress has been fitful, even in 2017, with the GOP in full control of the federal government. Conservative intellectuals, such as Ross Douthat, argued that the party is burdened by a weak, uninformed, erratic, and disinterested president. In quite sharp contrast, the Fittest 50 agenda of wage stagnation, deregulation, and tax cuts has been quite successfully pursued by GOP lawmakers. This allegiance to elite donors is especially evident on fortifying the legalities of pay-to-play, exemplified by the Senate Republicans' refusal during 2016 to even consider the Obama nomination of Judge Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley explains, "The thing the Republican leadership feared most was that an Obama Supreme Court nominee would rule against the huge influx of dark money into political campaigns that is corrupting our system of government. They feared this outcome more than any other because it is that dark money, a vast amount of which came from the Koch brothers and their organization, that has played a huge role in putting the Republicans in the Senate majority." Pursuing policy outcomes in disagreement with majoritarian economic preferences and their own grassroots has positioned the contemporary Republican Party well out of the American mainstream. Even so, this pattern may persist for many years until a progressive Supreme Court recriminalizes vote buying, thereby providing the freedom for lawmakers to end the income bias if they choose. That eventuality is the focus of Section 2.